From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 1 year ago, George Floyd's murder set off a movement against police brutality that reached across the world. Today, we'll talk about a bipartisan package of police reform bills in the state legislature. And we speak with an activist who's been pushing for Michigan police departments to deal with racial bias and traffic stops.
And I want to be able to travel through these places without fearing for my life, fearing for my family. I wanted answers.
Plus, the effort to rename University of Michigan's Yost Ice Arena.
Teams from the South would refuse to play against any team from the North if the team from the North had an African-American player. So they would insist that that player be benched. So that's exactly what happened in 1934. Fielding Yost arranged the game with Georgia Tech. They said, the only way we're going to play is if you bench Willis Ward.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Data from cities all across Michigan show that black drivers are more likely to be pulled over. Today we're going to talk with one woman who's working to change that.
I reacted to it this way because of what I keep seeing my family go through, what I see friends go through, how it personally affects me, and because it's just simply not fair.
That's later in the hour, but first, today is the anniversary of the killing of Minneapolis resident George Floyd by then police officer Derek Chauvin. We wanted to talk about the move for police reforms here in Michigan and why it's so hard to move forward with substantive changes that will protect the lives of black people interacting with law enforcement. There is a bipartisan package of bills in the Michigan State Senate right now that might cause some movement on the edges of police reform. Democratic State Senator Erica Geis is one of the bill's sponsors, and she joins us today. Senator Geis, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
I see that the bill would end no-knock warrants. Can you talk a little bit about that particular issue in policing and how this bill might change a disruptive practice?
Yeah, so my bill, 479, is the bill that would address no-knock warrants. The bill package, as you said, it's a bipartisan bill package, 12 bills in all. And, you know, I think most of us are familiar with no-knock warrants as it relates to the tragedy that occurred with Breonna Taylor.
We might also mention the death of a 7-year-old, Ayanna Jones, who was killed while she was sleeping in the middle of the night police raid in 2010 in Detroit.
Yes, exactly. And the bill would address, and there will be a sub right before committee. The bills are being heard in committee this Thursday morning in Judiciary Committee. That would address the use of no-knock warrants. It would ban them with the exception of certain circumstances and better defines what knock and enter warrants are. The judge ordering that type of warrant would have to explain the reasons for it, why some other type of warrant wouldn't have been appropriate in that circumstance. So it does maintain that judicial discretion and allows exceptions for instances where fear of violent resistance or ambushes could require an element of surprise. We've been working on this package for most of this year, this term. This package goes back to work we worked on last term, but didn't get through the process. So we're hopeful that with there being a hearing in committee and Judiciary Committee, that we'll actually be able to move on these bills that don't only include my bill, which is the no-knock warrant bill, but also use of force bills, a bill on the duty to intervene, de-escalation training, a chokehold ban, separation records where the violations of use of force policies are included in those separation records maintained by MCOLs, requiring independent investigations, requiring MCOL certification revocation if an officer has been found to have used excessive force causing death or seriously bodily harm. anonymity for complaints against police and related to tampering with body cameras.
We should say MCOLs, for those who don't follow this stuff closely, is Michigan's Commission on Law Enforcement Standards. Senator Geis,
yes,
I see
thank
that.
You. Sorry
yeah,
about
that's
the
okay. That's all right. Lansing stuff. I see that several Republicans are co-sponsors of these bills. There's Senator Roger Victory of Georgetown Township. How did the Republican support materialize?
Well, Senator Victory is now the chair of Judiciary, and Senator Chang is the Democratic vice chair of Judiciary, and they did work together on being able to come to some consensus on which bills, because there are other bills that some of us wanted to have included, but where we could find this common ground to be able to move a package forward that would hopefully improve the interactions of law enforcement and residents. And this is where we ended up with.
Yeah. What do you think was the selling point? We have seen some of Michigan's Republican representatives and senators support reform in sentencing in the past, but this feels like new territory for them. What do you think was the tipping point?
Someone like Senator Victory realizes that there is a need for change, and that we've seen, especially thinking about what occurred a year ago to Mr. Floyd, and so many others that we've seen over the past year, that something needs to be done, and that something is in the form of the legislative space in order to give departments, give chiefs the ability to address these problems of police brutality, particularly against members of the Black and Brown community. So I think that it's hard to ignore it when you are seeing it, when you're seeing it unfold, unfortunately, in real time, like we did a year ago. I think that might be where that common ground was able to be found.
The reform of police practice is such a hugely multi-layered issue across hundreds of Michigan jurisdictions. We've seen conversations at the federal level for whether qualified immunity should be continued and whether its elimination might have a part to play in this. How do you figure out where you can have the most impact on these issues?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We do have the conversations with the various stakeholders and trying to find where that impact can occur. We know that there will be opposition to these bills, that there will be both in the sense of the things that they might not want to do, but then also that there's always the risk that they might not go as far as the public might want them to. And one of the dances, so to speak, that occurs with legislation and with a package such as this, which is bipartisan, is finding those areas where we can get to a point of making improvements, even if it's incrementally. There is still much work to do. I will not deny that. And there are other bills that will have either been introduced or will likely be introduced at other times. But this is the package that this bipartisan package that is being led with to get our arms around addressing changes that need to happen in policing.
Right. I think you've got teenagers at home.
I do. One and one tween. One teenager, one tween.
We've got about a minute left. I was wondering how you've been talking to your kids about their interactions with the police and the momentum this year, whether it feels real.
Yeah, having a son who is on the cusp of being able to drive, he would have started, had we not been in pandemic times, he would have started driver's ed sooner. But it is a real conversation. It adds a new layer of fear and concern. It's a conversation that we have and that we will definitely have more often. I think the first time we had the talk was the first time he went with his friend somewhere. I drove him to meet his friends at the mall to go to the movies. And that was one of the first times that we had the talk that his existence being observed by others could be perceived as not who he is as a person, and that could result in bodily harm or death. And it's a very real conversation that parents of color have with their children that we shouldn't have to have.
State Senator Erica Geis, she is a Democrat from Taylor. Senator, thank you so much. We'll look forward to touching base with you as these bills move through the process.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. You have a great day.
A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking with one family from Detroit and hear how one mother's version of the talk led to one of her daughters taking up activism in a way that is making a difference in a couple of Southeast Michigan communities. That's later in the program. We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up after the break, an advisory committee to the University of Michigan recommends pulling the name Fielding Yost off of the arena in Michigan.
It was up to Fielding Yost to make the decision about whether or not Ward would be benched or whether they would just cancel the game or insist that he play. And Fielding Yost made the decision that Ward would be not only benched for the game, but that he wouldn't even be allowed in the stadium that day.
We'll talk about why in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. An advisory committee to the University of Michigan is recommending that the name Fielding Yost be removed from Yost Ice Arena. This is after an investigation into Yost's past actions, leading to the conclusion that this legendary coach and athletic director committed racist offenses against his own players. In 1934, Fielding Yost, who was then the U of M's athletic director, honored the request of Georgia Tech's football program that Michigan's black football player Willis Ward not be allowed to play in a game between the two schools, much to the chagrin of U of M's football team, including a future U.S. president, number 48, Gerald Ford. With us to talk more about the circumstances and the investigation is Buddy Morehouse. He's a former newspaper editor, and he made a film documentary about Willis Ward entitled Black and Blue, the story of Gerald Ford, Willis Ward, and the 1934 Michigan-Georgia Tech football game. Buddy Morehouse, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Great to be here.
From what you've been able to learn, what happened between Fielding Yost and Willis Ward that the committee felt was most egregious?
Well, Willis Ward, as you said, was a football player and a track star at the University of Michigan in the early 1930s. He grew up in Detroit, graduated from Detroit Northwestern, and at the time he graduated, he was one of the best high school athletes in the country. He came to Michigan with the understanding that he would be able to both run track and play football there, even though Michigan had not had an African-American football player in more than 30 years. And when he came to Michigan, Fielding Yost was not the coach, he was the athletic director. The coach was a man named Harry Kipke. And when Willis Ward came to Ann Arbor that year. It was with the understanding he'd be able to run track and play football. And everything went just fine for the first 3 years he was at Michigan. But when he was a senior, Michigan scheduled a game against Georgia Tech. And back then, there was a terrible Jim Crow practice that said that teams from the South would refuse to play against any team from the North if the team from the North had an African-American player. So they would insist that that player be benched for that game, and then the team from the South would bench a player of equal ability to keep things fair, you know, to keep things fair on the field, supposedly. Right. So that's exactly what happened in 1934. Fielding Yost arranged the game with Georgia Tech. They said that the only way we're going to play is if you bench Willis Ward.
Where was the game supposed to be held? Was it in Michigan or in Georgia?
It was in Michigan. It was at Michigan Stadium.
I mean, part of me wondered when I first heard about this, is there a possibility that Fielding Yost might have thought, well, if we go down there, you know, my player might be at risk from racist attacks for violence. But this was a game on the home field.
And there was never any question that the game was going to take place in Ann Arbor. Michigan had an opening on their schedule that year. So the year before that, Fielding Yost had been looking around for an opponent to fill that gap in their schedule. And he wanted to play a team from the South. So he contacted Georgia Tech and they arranged the game. There was never any question that the game was going to be played in Ann Arbor. And so the game was scheduled for 1934. Georgia Tech said that the only way they would play the game is if Willis Ward would be benched. And at that time, he was Michigan's best player, along with probably his best friend on the team, Gerald Ford. And it was up to Fielding Yost to make the decision about whether or not Ward would be benched or whether they would just cancel the game or insist that he play. And Fielding Yost made the decision that Ward would be not only benched for the game, but that he wouldn't even be allowed in the stadium that day.
What do we know about how Willis Ward felt about this decision?
He was embarrassed. He was humiliated by what happened. He was also very heartened by the response from his teammates, especially Gerald Ford. Ford actually said that he was going to quit the team in response to it. And Willis Ward told him that, no, this is not a battle that you have. This is a battle that they have with me. You need to go out and play, and you need to win the game. And you need to do it for the team and for me. And so that's what Gerald Ford did. So Ward was very heartened by the response from his teammates at the time. But the incident had such a profound impact on him that the next year was the Olympics in Berlin in 1936, where Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals. And Willis Ward at the time was just as fast as Jesse Owens. He was an incredible track athlete. And there was no question that he would have also won gold medals that year. But he was so disheartened by what had happened in 1935 with the Georgia Tech game that he decided he was going to quit sports altogether. And he never competed in the Olympics and never competed in another sporting event after that.
Mm. In the course of your research, what did you learn about Fielding Yost's views on race that might inform the decision that he made?
He was the son of a Confederate soldier. He grew up in West Virginia. His father was, he had served under Robert E. Lee. He was a physician in the Confederate Army. So he came from the South, and he brought a lot of those values with him when he came into the North, into Michigan. There was no question that he wanted his football teams to remain all white. He became Michigan's football coach in 1901, and he was there for 20-some years before becoming athletic director. The entire time that he was there, there was never an African-American football player on Michigan's team. Now, there were in other sports, in track and in baseball particularly. Michigan had a number of outstanding African-American athletes, but never in football. But it was really the incident in 1934 with Willis Ward where this kind of all came out, his true feelings about race.
It sounds like what happened around the decision really started a ripple effect throughout the Michigan student body. Can you tell us about what happened as word of this started spreading?
It was an enormous story in 1934 when the game happened, and it caused a firestorm on campus. in the weeks leading up to the game, Michigan never actually came out and said that Willis Ward was going to be benched, but there was this rumor going around that that was going to happen. And everybody knew that the only way Georgia Tech would play the game is if Ward was benched. So Michigan started getting inundated with telegrams and letters and postcards and phone calls from all over the country, from Michigan alumni primarily. And most all of them said that there's no way that this is not what Michigan is. There's no way that Michigan should play this game if Willis Ward is benched. And we had a lot of them in our movie, Black and Blue, a lot of these cards and letters and telegrams that came in. And then the week of the game, there were a lot of protests on campus. And the night before the game, there was a huge rally that took place on campus. And it was a lot of people in support of benching Willis Ward, because these were mostly like the frat boys and some of those groups that were in support of benching Willis Ward. They said that these are our guests from the South and we need to respect them and their traditions. And then there were a lot more people, including most of the faculty at Michigan, who said that, you know, no, this is just an outrage. There's no way that Willis Ward should be benched. But it was not a quiet thing at all when it happened in 1934. It was an enormous event on campus.
So what was Fielding Yost's reaction to all this backlash?
His reaction at that time was he did not publicly say a word. We know that there were a lot of things going on behind the scenes. The group that was in charge of Michigan athletics back then was the Board in Control of Intercollegiate Athletics, and they held a meeting leading up to the game, and everyone at that time knew that Yost had made the decision that Ward was going to be benched. They held a meeting leading up to it, and we have the minutes of that meeting where everyone had their say. And basically, that's at the time when Yost said that we need to not publicly say anything. If Willis Ward says something, that's fine, but we're not going to say anything. We're just going to do this. We're just going to let this happen. So for the rest of his life, Fielding Yost never publicly said anything about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Buddy Morehouse, a journalist and creator of the documentary film Black and Blue, the story of Gerald Ford, Willis Ward, and the 1934 Michigan-Georgia Tech football game. If Fielding Yost was willing to do this to Willis Ward, to take him out of the picture so that Michigan could play Georgia Tech, I mean, why did he even have Willis on the team at all? I understand that Willis came into the program at a time when Yost maybe wouldn't have had any say in it. But I guess, how did things get to this point even?
Well, there are a lot of people who think that he never wanted Willis Ward on the team to begin with, and that it was Harry Kipke, his coach, who fought for him to be on the team. Yost, of course, never publicly said anything one way or another, but there are a lot of people who believe that he never wanted Ward on the team to begin with, and that all kind of came to a head in the Georgia Tech incident. He really viewed his football team differently than the other sports on campus. He had no problem with African Americans on the track team or the baseball team or some of the other sports, but football, he just, for whatever reason, because that was his sport, he wanted that to remain all white.
His defenders, I guess, although they may not approve of what he did, people who disagree with the decision to remove his name sometimes say that this was a time in which segregation was just embedded in American culture in so many ways that it's not really fair to apply the modern standard to what happened back then. Whether or not you agree with it, I wonder if you can put that in the context of the times. It certainly sounds like there were people at the time who saw this, you know, as really deeply problematic and said so.
Exactly. I have a lot of problems with the way this commission went about this whole process, but I think that the thing that they did get right in there is that they did point out that Yost was, it's not like everybody at Michigan felt the same way about this, as you said. There were a lot of people, most of the students, almost all of his teammates, the faculty on there, all the alumni, who were vehemently opposed to this, vehemently opposed to him being benched. There were some people who were also in agreement with it, but it's not like everybody back then felt the same way and that this was just the culture in Michigan at the time, because that's not at all the case. This was not a case where everybody had the same opinion back then.
Yeah. You know, our society has come up with a couple of different, I'd say, newer processes for thinking about American history as we've reexamined things like Confederate memorials or other people in American history and in Michigan history who espoused views that now we find, you know, really unacceptable. Sometimes people say, take them down, change the names, move forward. These are not idols that we want to hold up to our children and future generations. There are some people who say, you know what, leave it there, but let's provide some context. Could you see that happening in this case? Is there a way to hold, you know, different perceptions in balance and help people understand what was going on in 1934?
That's one of the agreement or one of the recommendations that this commission put forth that I totally agree with, is that they say that whatever we do with Fielding Yost on campus in the future, we need to make sure that we tell the story of Willis Ward alongside that. If we're going to keep Yost's name on the building, then there needs to be a plaque in there that talks all about Willis Ward as well. If we honor him in any way in the football complex, we need to be putting this in the context of telling the story of Willis Ward as well. And I'm totally in favor of that. Anything that we can do to get out the story of Willis Ward is a good thing, in my opinion. Willis Ward is somebody I never had the opportunity to meet when he was alive. He died in 1983, but he is one of my heroes. The way he lived his life, not just his time at Michigan, but the things that he did after that, he's one of the most incredible people we have ever had in this state. Not just as an athlete, but as a person. So anything that we can do to get the story of Willis Ward out there is a good thing, in my opinion.
Can you tell us a little more about the later years of Willis Ward's life?
Yeah, he was an incredible person. And one of the things I always keep in mind when I'm thinking about Willis Ward is that he never let what happened in 1934 define him or hold him back at all. When he graduated from Michigan, he got a job right away working for the Ford Motor Company. Henry Ford himself was a huge Willis Ward fan, and he hired Willis Ward to be kind of an unofficial civil rights liaison within his company.
Wait. Henry Ford, who was known to not exactly have generous views of equality of all men and women.
Exactly. He loved Willis Ward, though.
That's fascinating.
He also knew that the only way his auto factories in Detroit were going to be successful is if they were able to have a number of African-American employees. And there were a lot of tensions back then between, my understanding of it is that there were a lot of tensions back then between management and the workers. So he hired Willis Ward to kind of be a liaison between the black workers and the management at the Ford Motor Company. And he held that, he's one of the highest ranking African-American executives in America at the time, and he's in his early 20s then. He was extremely successful in that job, but he wanted to go to law school because he wanted to become a civil rights attorney and hopefully a judge. And Henry Ford begged him to stay at the company. He said he would give him twice as much money as any legal firm ever would, but Ward wanted to become an attorney. So he went to law school. He graduated from there. He got a job in the prosecutor's office prosecuting civil rights cases. He later went on to become the chairman of the Michigan Public Service Commission. And then he was, in the early 1960s, he was appointed as Wayne County's first African-American probate court judge by Governor Romney. And the person who lobbied him to appoint Ward to that position was Gerald Ford, who was at that time a congressman. And then he served in that position. He was a probate court judge in Wayne County for the rest of his life until he died in 1983.
What are your reservations about how the committee approached the issue of Fielding Yost and his place in Michigan history?
The big problem that I have with the way they went about this is that they essentially tried and convicted Fielding Yost without calling any witnesses at all. The first time that anybody outside of this panel knew about this commission and this report and this recommendation was yesterday when it became public. And the one that really upsets and offends me is that Willis Ward's own family never knew about this, that this was happening. They were never asked for their input. They were never asked for their perspective on anything. They didn't even know that this was happening until it came out yesterday. So I think Michigan did a really poor job of bringing other people into the conversation. They also did not include any Michigan football historians. There are a couple people, John U. Bacon and Greg Dooley, who know the story of Fielding Yost better than anyone. There's a history professor named Tyron Stewart, who we interviewed in our film, Black and Blue, who knows the story of Willis Ward better than anyone. And none of those people were even told that this was happening. So I think that they would have benefited by having more perspectives and more voices, particularly Willis Ward's family.
Buddy Morehouse is the maker of the film Black and Blue, the story of Gerald Ford, Willis Ward, and the 1934 Michigan-Georgia Tech football game. Buddy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, April.
We reached out to the University of Michigan for comment. While representatives for the U of M did not weigh in on the recommendation, they say, quoting here, in 2020, multiple requests to remove the honorific name of Fielding H. Yost from the ice arena were received and referred to the President's Advisory Committee on University History for review pursuant to our established process in such cases. The committee's preliminary recommendation comes after a year of study by the panel of university historians. You can read a full version of the statement at our website. And just a reminder, the University of Michigan holds Michigan Radio's broadcast license. Still to come, a deeper look into policing of black people in mostly white communities in Southeast Michigan. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The national conversation sparked by the killing of George Floyd 1 year ago today has brought a lot of people to dig into the ways that inequality has touched our lives. One of the people seeking answers is Alexandria Hughes, an activist, a black woman. She lives in Southeast Michigan. Michigan Radio's Beenish Ahmed reported in a feature that aired today about Hughes' family story, the things that her mother told Hughes and her brothers about how to try and protect themselves from the use of force by police. Alexandria Hughes wanted to find out if her mother's sense of police's focused attention on black drivers was based in fact. So she started digging, and she's here to tell us more about what she found. Alexandria Hughes, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
There may be folks here who didn't hear Beenish's story this morning. Can you tell us a little bit about your mother's advice?
Yes. Growing up, my mother would always tell me, you know, when dealing with police, to be polite, to keep my hands on the wheel, and to not give them a reason to use force, which meant having your paperwork together, is how she would put it. And this was at a young age. This was like middle school. Mm. And that's what she would tell me and my siblings in preparation for what may happen. Hopefully not, but you know, that was her being a protective mom, trying to prevent anything from happening.
Yeah. You have four brothers, right? And one sister?
Yes, I have four brothers. I have a sister, really big family.
It seems like despite your mom's best efforts, they still had really difficult experiences with the police. Are there moments that stand out for you?
Absolutely. Moments that stand out most is the experiences my younger brother, Ayub, had in Livonia with the police following him home. Keep in mind, you know, we weren't residents of Livonia. Following him home, and that happened multiple times. And also just how it shifted, you know, how his behavior was going forward. And just thinking about how other experiences he's had previously at a younger age and, you know, before being an adult when that happened, being a minor when things happened, and that, and just other experiences I know my brothers have had. And it's hard to keep track of how many times they've been pulled over, to be quite honest.
Yeah. I know there was one incident where he was pulled over and ticketed for driving 1 mile over the speed limit.
Yes. that was pretty recent, like just 1 mile. Like, that is insane. That is, it's targeting.
Yeah.
You're waiting. You're just waiting.
you're waiting for Black people to cross paths with you so you can pull us over. 1 mile is not harming anybody. If anything, we should be afraid that you're going to harm us.
You filed public records requests with two cities, Livonia and Dearborn. As you started to think what you could find out and what you could do about this, we should mention that you don't live in either city, but I take it these are places that you have occasion to drive through now and then?
Yeah, you know, Livonia, that being right by Redford, you know, city where family members are, like a lot of my family members, that's somewhere we would frequent through when I did live out there. And Dearborn is a place I work in, the place I graduated from college in. And I have many friends in Dearborn. And I want to be able to travel through these places without fearing for my life, fearing for my family. I wanted answers. And that's what I've been trying to do currently, is get those answers.
Can you sort of give us a thumbnail sketch of what you found out about traffic stops and who they impacted in both towns?
Yeah. So with Livonia, I saw that half of the people they arrest and half of the people that receive citations are Black. And this was 2019 data I was looking at. And also in the 2020 data, you see the same numbers. Now, some may say the numbers are a little lower in 2020. Maybe they are changing things. I challenge that by saying Governor Whitmore put in place a lot of regulations to the point where you couldn't arrest and cite people for certain, not having certain things together with their vehicle, for example. So I don't really give them credit for that. But the numbers are still almost half still.
Not to mention the fact that it was lockdown. I mean, people weren't driving as much, so you'd expect the numbers to go down, right?
Yes, exactly. So it was still substantially high for being Livonia being a city with less than 5%, according to the census, less than 5% is Black of the population there. So there's no excuse. And even in Dearborn, I'm seeing the same thing. In Dearborn, we happen to get data from 2010 to 2020. And even in that data, we see an increase in the amount of citations being issued to Black people, an increase in the amount of arrests, 56% of arrests happening to Black people. And in that data, even finding that there is a team that was once called the Border Crimes Initiatives team that is now named the TAC team. That name was changed this year. And that team borders, they watch Dearborn and Detroit, what happens in between the two places. And then that was where a lot of the citations came from, was from that team. So not only are you pulling over Black people, you have a task force designed to do that. And these are the things I found in the data. And it took a lot for me to look at all of it, if I'm being quite honest. It took a lot of breaks and other people that were able to assist, just because personally it's just a lot to take in.
Right. We should say that in the course of this, you've become active with a group that's called Livonia Citizens Caring About Black Lives. And you and the group took the information that you got, went back to the city in Livonia, and explained what you'd found. What was it that you were asking them to do?
I was asking them to put in place policies that would prevent Black people from being harmed, harassed. A lot of the feedback I got was, we hear your story, we hear you, but that is not current Livonia. I've had council members tell me racism doesn't permeate the city of Livonia. I've had council members ignore what I was saying and other members of Livonia Citizens Group. I've had council members switch the conversation to talk about Chick-fil-A instead, that was coming to Livonia and laughing about it. I'm like, okay. Just clearly disregarding the problem at hand. And it's not something you can deal with later. It's something really urgent. So it requires immediate action. And I'm not seeing that in Livonia.
Officials in Livonia, after you talked to them, started adding information about citations and arrests to its police department website. And the city's leaders charged the Human Relations Commission to make recommendations about police reform, kind of suggesting further, quote unquote, further study is needed. I want to read from a statement that Mayor Maureen Miller-Brosnan sent to our reporter, Beenish Ahmed. She writes, since the Human Relations Commission was reconstituted in June of 2020, it's met every month to serve as a space for the community to come together and hold important conversations about equity and inclusion. And she continues, I look forward to the commission continuing their work of providing recommendations on an ongoing basis. Alexandria, how do you respond to what Livonia says it's doing about this?
You know, I appreciate that effort being taken, but my worry is that doesn't immediately stop the problem. You know, having that commission to make recommendations, to look into things, look into, not solve, not stop, not provide a way for Black people to get justice if something happens to us again. I would like to see policy change that would prevent racist outcomes. And having police oversight commissions made up of civilians and people who are not biased and within the police department, that would provide a real chance for justice. Ending qualified immunity in Livonia would provide a chance for Black people to be able to defend ourselves from an institution that is supposed to protect us, that is not. That is really taking a chance and stepping out there and trying to solve the problem immediately, because every day you don't, it's another Black person being harmed. Commissions only look into things. I appreciate the attempt. That is not enough.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Alexandria Hughes. She's done activist work in several Metro Detroit suburbs, informed by her family's experience of racial profiling by law enforcement and driving around in these predominantly white spaces. Alexandria, I wanted to ask you, you watched so much happen to your brothers and other Black people that you know. It's very clear that these experiences really mobilized you and activated you. Do you know why that is, that you reacted to it in this way when it can be so deeply paralyzing for some people?
For me, I reacted to it this way because of what I keep seeing my family go through, what I see friends go through, how it personally affects me on a traumatic level, and because it's just simply not fair. You know, there's moments throughout my life that has put me more and more invested, and I just got fed up. I said, something has to stop. I'm going to do everything I can. I have to change this. I cannot live this way. Those are all the thoughts that would come in my mind as a youth and as a young adult, and just as I go through life. And I just got to a point, I just had to try to solve it. And just Sandra Bland, seeing her die, and it was many parallels between myself and her, and not to say the others who passed due to the hands of police weren't as crucial they were, but with her, it was someone who was young, Black, college educated, an activist. It was someone who was way similar to myself, and I just needed to make a change on a major level. So just trying to do that.
We should say that, like, none of this is your day job. Your profession is in mental health as a behavior therapist. Would you say that that is in some ways informed what you felt like you needed to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Naturally, I've always been someone who loves to help people, who wants the best for everybody. And me as a behavior therapist, you know, I work with people of all shades, and I try to make everyone feel on the same level as anyone else in the room. And I feel like doing that every day and being a therapist, it helps to inform my work, because I'm able to help other people and talk to other people in my family and really try to solve the problems. I would definitely say another reason, and not just relation to what keeps happening to Black people and police brutality, but my profession is connected to my work, because I see a lack of
a lack of energy put into mental health resources. And if we cared about each other more in each other's mental states, we would begin to understand what each person requires. What does humanity look like for someone who is Black? It looks different from someone who is white or Arab or Asian. And if we focused on mental health and we would start thinking about humanity. And that's another reason why I am so invested. I want us to get back to those. I want us to get to those things. Just get to them.
Yeah. It feels like this is probably a very delicate balance to talk people through. Sometimes taking action can be so cathartic and can give people more of a sense of agency, even when they feel all the weight of what's happening. And sometimes people just need to take care of themselves and have other spaces in their lives where the word police doesn't even come up. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit how you steer people through that, or maybe how you balance it yourself?
Balancing it all, it is tough. I'll say, honestly, self-care is a big thing I'm always preaching to a lot of people. And honestly, that's how I'm able to keep that space, able to deal with it when it does come up. There's not exactly a way to just keep it from coming up, because America is about race. That is America. But I feel like you have to find a way to deal with it. And self-care is how I deal with it. And I feel a lot of people should deal with it.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you a bit about your activism in Dearborn. You are also part of the group Accountability for Dearborn, and your public records request there found that Black drivers were also ticketed in the city disproportionate to their population, like you said. And the response from the city is kind of interesting. Some city leaders told you that if you don't live in the city of Dearborn, which you don't, your concerns should not really be a large part of Dearborn's discussion. What did you think when you heard that?
I thought that was extremely racist to say to someone that my voice doesn't matter. That's essentially what it's saying. And knowing the history of Dearborn, that is the same thing they were saying back in the 70s, the 60s, the 50s. They were saying, keep Dearborn clean, which meant, according to Orville Hubbard, keep Dearborn non-Black. And that is exactly what they're saying. And that is exactly what they're doing with the police currently. Anybody should have the ability to travel wherever they want to. If I want to go and hang out with a friend in Dearborn, I should be able to do that.
So I know that you're going to a demonstration today ahead of a Dearborn City Council meeting. What do you hope is going to come out of this?
I hope to see City Council take action and put in place policies that will stop racism against Black people, that will stop racist outcomes from happening to Black people. I hope to see City Council pass resolutions to declare racism a public health crisis and put in place teams to start to look into the fabric of each department within the city of Dearborn that continues racism, because it does, and it will if no action is taken.
Do you still feel the danger that you were feeling 1 year ago at this time?
Yes, absolutely.
Alexandria Hughes, she lives in Southeast Michigan, works in the mental health field, and has been involved with the group Livonia Citizens Caring About Black Lives, and also with Accountability for Dearborn. Alexandria, thank you so much, and we wish you and your family a very safe summer.
Thank you so much.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Paid internships at Michigan Radio are made possible by the Robin Fleming Public Media Internship Endowment. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.